This is Jennifer Walden, and you are listening to the A Sound Effect Podcast. Director Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 2 is now in theaters, and the sound does not disappoint. From thrilling sandworm rides to peaceful sand walks through the desert of Arrakis, the sound is a mesmerizing journey that's heart-pounding at times and heady in others. Oscar-winning supervising sound editor Richard King at Warner Brothers Post-Production Creative Services in Burbank is here to talk about his journey of editing the sound on Dune Part 2. Richard collaborated with a team of recordists and editors, some working halfway around the globe in New Zealand, to get the sound of this epic film into shape for the dub stage, with just 2.5 months to do it in. Here Richard talks about how they captured tons of field recordings of sand and wind to lend a realistic feeling to the deserts on Arrakis, how they created the sound for the sandworms, and his sonic inspiration for Paul's white-knuckled sandworm ride. He also talks about recording massive group ADR sessions for the Harkonnen arena scene, adding grit to the scenes, preparing the effects tracks for the dub stage, and much, much more.
Hey everyone, my name is Espen Andersen, and I'm the founder of asoundeffect.com. Before we begin the interview, let's hear some highlights from the newest independent sound effect libraries at asoundeffect.com. Abandoned Oil Tank by Katrine Amsler. Wild Himalayas by Earth Experience. Naughty by Hervé and Works. Metal Motion by Studio Obsidian. You'll find all of these sound libraries and many more at asoundeffect.com/shop. Oh, and a heads up. If you're feeling creative, be sure to take part in our huge sound design contest at asoundeffect.com/sounddesign24, that's sounddesign24, where you get 7 chances to win wild prizes from Mattia Gelato. And as a bonus, he's also running a sale where you get 20-25% off all his libraries and bundles right now. That's asoundeffect.com/sounddesign24. And now, back to the interview.
Hey, Richard.
Hello.
Thanks for having this chat. I am so thrilled to be talking about the sound editing on Dune Part 2.
Well, I'm really pleased to talk to you about this movie, Jennifer. I love this film and loved working on it. And I think you're one of the best at this sort of thing there is. So it's a pleasure to get to talk to you about it.
Well, thanks, Richard. I'm so happy to be here to talk with you about it. So I had a chance actually to talk with the re-recording mixers, Ron Bartlett and Doug Hemphill, and they had so many great things to say about the sound editorial side.
I've known both of them for about 40 years, unbelievably. And Ron, I think, cut Foley for me on my first show that I've supervised, and Doug mixed effects on the second show that I supervised. So we all kind of started out roughly at the same time. So there's a real deep friendship there and a deep understanding of each other and a very similar aesthetic regarding sound. So it was a blast working with those guys.
And what about working with Denis? Have you ever worked with him before? How did you kind of get started on Dune Part 2? And when did he bring you on board?
No, I had not met Denis. I'd been an admirer of his films for a long time. But I was brought in fairly late in the process. You know, I literally had, I think, 2.5 months before we started mixing to prepare the show.
Wow.
So Denis and I had a spotting session with Joe, the picture editor. We kind of went through the film and I got his take on the overall vibe of the show and what he was imagining the world of Dune to be like. And one of the words that he used a number of times was documentary. He wanted the film to really feel like you were hearing what was recorded, you know, on the day that they shot the scene. Very real, very tactile, very recognizably real. And, you know, in that way, I think the audience is better able to immerse themselves in the world. They're not holding it at arm's length. Like in Star Wars movies, everything's quite exaggerated and there's a certain aesthetic that they adhere to that kind of keeps you at arm's length a little bit. It's clearly a fable being told to you from a long time ago, far away. And Denis wanted Dune to be a place that felt as if you could imagine yourself being there. Denis had a lot of specific thoughts. He also was very open to new ideas to expand the sonic world of Dune. And we had lots of opportunities to do that in Dune 2, as there are more action scenes, there are more big set pieces, there's more big, cool machinery and seismic weather events that happen. So we had a great time, and it was a wild ride.
So let's talk about some of the field recordings that were done for the film. Ron and Doug had mentioned some interesting sand recordings that you and Charlie Campagna captured. These cool sand footsteps for when the characters are sliding down the dunes. So Doug described it as a low undulating sound of the sand shifting deep underneath them. Can you talk about that and the other field recording trips you did for the film?
Yes, there's a sound that we refer to as a sand groan, which can either be a very long sound. If you slide a large plate of sand down the face of a dune, the compression creates a very low end sound that radiates down from the sand to the sublayer of harder sand or rock way down and then bounces back. And it's a very, very low, like almost subharmonic frequency groaning sound. It's very interesting sound, very organic sounding. Also, when you walk down the face of a dune, you get these little on every step caused by the same phenomenon. Eric Potter, actually, and Charlie Campagna spent probably a couple of weeks out in the desert on three different recording expeditions to Death Valley and to Kelso Dunes and to a couple of other places in the Mojave Desert to get those sorts of sounds, as well as walking in sand, as well as the sound of the Fremen who bury themselves with little snorkels to breathe through and then burst out of the sand to attack. We got those kinds of sounds. We did everything that we could possibly do or imagine that we would possibly need involving sand and different kinds of sand, different textures of sand. We're on Arrakis for almost the entire film in Dune 2 and in different parts of the planet. And so we needed different qualities of sand, different textures of sand, because it clearly looks different in different locations on Arrakis. So there was a lot of field recording in the desert. There was a lot of field recording getting the sounds of machinery that we would then pitch and manipulate and use for things like the harvesters and sweeteners for the ornithopters and other mechanical stuff. We did a lot of recording and a lot of kind of R&D to see what sorts of sounds would be appropriate and have that kind of gritty feeling that he wanted.
Yeah, it definitely had a gritty feeling. The desert and the sand sounds, they were like amazing. So there's this one scene in which they send Paul out into the desert to survive on his own. It's like this nice quiet moment and you hear these winds singing over the sand and all the little sand particles. Mm. You can almost feel like you're sitting there getting gritty.
Yeah, we also sent a recordist, George Vlad, out to the Sahara Desert to record wind. And he recorded a beautiful collection of winds from absolutely dead calm to gale force or to, you know, sandstorm force. And those were really beautifully recorded and really helpful. And did a lot of recording at night, as did Charlie and Eric. They had to record at night, first of all, because of the heat, because we were working in summer and it's very hot. There are flies, but they were able to work all night in much more moderate, comfortable conditions and set up work lights and work by the light of either the full moon or work lights. And yeah, so sand was a big deal. And I imagined in designing the equipment that at least on Arrakis, all the equipment, it's got sand in it. It's lived a hard life. None of this equipment, save for some of the Harkonnen equipment, because their stuff, we designed that to be very sort of high tech and still relatable as sort of recognizable big machinery, but it's higher tech, it's slicker, it's smoother. But the equipment on Arrakis, you know, has been through the mill. So it all has a little flavor of rust, of sand in the gears, just to add that level of believability.
And so when you were laying out the tracks for the re-recording mixers, did you have an actual grit layer that they could play with in the mix when they wanted to hear a little more of that?
Well, the tracks were put together and designed a little more concisely than that. And I was able to pre-dub the effects myself. For one thing, I wanted Denis to be able to hear, you know, what we were doing in context and fully realized, just to get his feedback. And also to make the mix much more efficient. I feel like if we go into the mix really prepared and with a specific idea, without 50 wind tracks, but 4 or 5 that are really good and that all work and that work together, then we have a starting point that I feel like works. And then we can expand from there. It was edited and designed and premixed by me pretty concisely. And then it was only made better and better and better with the input of and the, you know, mixing chops of Doug and Ron.
And did Foley help contribute to that gritty feeling?
Yes. Dan O'Connell and John Cucci at One Step Up did the Foley, and they brought in truckloads of different kinds of sand, different qualities, grits. So the footsteps and the sand movement and the sand sounds in general are a combination of Foley that Dan and John did, and the sand recordings that Eric and Charlie did.
So staying on the subject of sand, but getting more epic in scale, can you talk about what went into the sound of the sandworms?
Yeah, that went through an evolution because I thought it would be a lot more interesting rather than playing the vocalizations of the worms, which is kind of the go-to, kind of the obvious choice, right? When a big creature opens its maw and you see inside of it, the audience's expectation is to hear some vocalization. Well, I kind of thought, well, they're the only large creature in this entire environment. They would really have no evolutionary reason to roar, to threaten something else. They have no threat. They have no natural enemies except each other. So I thought it'd be a lot more interesting to convey their scale. These things are kilometers long, and they're probably thousands of tons of meat that just fly through the desert like a freight train. And I thought it'd be a lot more interesting to make their interaction with the environment the sound, and thereby accentuate their mass and their scale and their sheer power. So we did a lot of work with large objects moving through sand, over sand, under sand. We buried microphones in the sand and dragged large objects over them. We recorded a lot of grit that way that then we were then able to pitch and manipulate and make feel more massive. Particularly for Paul's worm ride, the wind was a big critical factor that I think makes it feel really threatening and scary. And I wanted it to feel almost like a storm at sea, like he's barely hanging on for dear life and being, you know, whipped by wind and waves of sand. It was almost like a scene out of Master and Commander, or almost like he was surfing on this huge thing, trying to gain control of it while it's trying to buck him off. It's twisting so that he gets closer and closer to the ground and might get crushed underneath it. And so the scene just had to have this feeling of terrifying chaos, like anything could happen. It's not safe. It's not predictable. You don't know that he's going to master this thing. Only when he begins to master it, you get the feeling that, yeah, he's now gaining control of it. Doug did a very cool, dramatic frequency shift out of the sound effects into a much more subdued sound effects field into the heroic music as Paul stands up and finally has control.
You really do feel the danger of Paul riding this huge sandworm. I thought you guys did a really good job of conveying that he's in mortal danger here.
Yeah, and the images they captured of that were so convincing and so real. It did not feel like anything that was shot on a soundstage, or it really rang true. It felt real. It's almost like this worm is so big, it's so vast, has so much mass that it creates its own gravity around it. And yeah, I thought the putting together of it, the shooting and Joe's cutting of it was just masterful. So we had a lot to live up to sonically to match that feeling.
But also a lot to work with. I mean, the visuals gave you a lot to work with, like waves of sand that come over him. You know, there's just a lot of opportunity for sound here.
Yeah, a brief side story. It kept reminding me of Master and Commander. Peter Weir taught Doug and I a very good lesson on that. We mixed this storm scene where they're rounding Cape Horn in a storm, in a gale, chasing another ship. And we had created all the tracks, we'd done all the pre-dubs, but we hadn't mixed all the pre-dubs together in a cohesive mix. But we wanted to play for Peter what we had, the elements, the water, the wind, the sails flapping, the ship creaking, the voices. And so we just wanted to show him the tableau that we had without having tweaked it yet. So we played it for him. It was a mess. It was chaos. It was too loud. It was too quiet in places. It was all over the place. And he said, "I love it. Now spend another day or so and do whatever tweaks you want to do, and I'll come back tomorrow and listen to it again." And so Doug and I got every wave just the right level, got every splintering of the mass as it breaks just right. We got all voices audible, and we played it for Peter the following day, and he was let down. He said, "I think it was better before." And the lesson he taught us was that you can overwork something and you can suck all the life out of it that way, especially in a moment like that, which needs to feel terrifying and chaotic, and you really don't know what's going to happen in the next moment. And the worm ride for me was very much like that. And I thought of Peter's lesson a lot in working on that scene.
Yeah, that's a really good lesson. You know, it's almost like depth of field for sound. If all the sounds are the same level, you know, if everything's kind of in focus, then it feels flat. So you almost need that messiness of sound levels to add a feeling of depth, and also to make it feel more real, like more realistic.
Yeah. And the occasional sound that's just crazy too loud and just unexpected. You want the audience to really not know what's going to happen in the next second and just feel on the edge of their seat. And so it was really fun to try to achieve that.
So there are a bunch of different sandworms in Dune Part 2. They ride a fleet of them to the south of Arrakis. Mm-hmm. And during the big end battle, there are three worms, I think, that they use for the attack. Mm-hmm. So did you have a slightly different palette of sound for those moments when we have more than one worm? Like, does Sandworm Jim sound a bit different than Sandworm Timmy?
Well, they're all roughly the same size. Really, the sound differences were more dictated by what they were doing than their individual personality, so to speak. We used one sound from Dune 1 a couple of times in the film, which was kind of a clonk, clonk, clonk sound that it makes. That is a kind of mysterious, cool sound that isn't appropriate in a battle scene or in a scene where it's being overtly threatening, but it's really effective as a kind of a mysterious sound. So we use it a little bit just before the giant worm, you know, appears out of the mist towards the end of the film. And we used it when they summon the worm to eat the dead Harkonnens that they've killed. Otherwise, the sounds of the worms were, like I said, the sounds of this 1,000 tons of meat interacting with an environment of sand and moving really fast and with great agility. You know, can leap out of the sand, they can go underneath the sand.
Yeah, sand is like water. I thought that was a great comparison.
Yeah.
Very fitting.
Yeah, and then he used that analogy often in describing what the background should be like, that it is a lot like the ocean or a lot like a snow-covered landscape. Very, very, very quiet and muffled. And the desert of Arrakis is a place of many different and widely varied moods and intensities and can go from quiet, peaceful, mysterious, to raging sandstorm, crazy wind that, as they say in the film, can rip the finish off steel. So it's an interesting environment to find backgrounds for. And the winds that George Flatt recorded in Africa were a real boon. We also created some bird sounds and animal sounds. We didn't want to use any terrestrial sounds of animals, of course. So we made some birds and kind of mysterious animals and insect sounds that seemed to fit the mood of Arrakis. That could be heard at night. Denis' idea was that the little critters come out at night, but during the day they're asleep underneath the sand or in a cave or whatever. But at night they all creep out and make themselves known.
You mentioned working with George Vlad. You also got to work with Martin Kwok and Dave Whitehead in New Zealand. They created the entire Fairman language. They did the arena scene with all those big crowds. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that? Like, were you involved with that in any way? Or was that something that they had done before you came onto the film?
No, they did it. It was being done concurrently. And they did an enormous amount of work with that, also with the Harkonnen voices. Many, many, many loop group sessions were done, which we got just in the nick of time before the actor strike happened. We did loop group sessions here in LA and also a whole bunch of them in New Zealand. Martin was the kind of lead on that, and Dave did a lot of processing work and multiplication work, like taking smaller crowds and making them sound huge. Dave Bach here in LA also did a lot of work with that. He was helping to make the smaller groups that Martin had recorded in New Zealand into huge arena size groups. Martin did a group with a bunch of punk rockers in New Zealand who were very uninhibited in their vocal expressions.
Awesome.
And could just like let their freak flag fly and not feel inhibited.
Yeah.
And that stuff was great for the Harkonnens, who are basically just a race of crazed lunatics. You know, when they get excited in the arena, they're, I don't know if it would have been like Roman gladiatorial combat, but probably like that times 1,000.
Yeah, there was definitely a sense of bloodlust.
Yeah.
So what was the most challenging scene for sound? What were some of your challenges and what went into it?
Yeah, well, it was all challenging. It was challenging for the time that we had to do it. There was a lot of working from the gut, which I think is not a bad thing. And I think it might be, it worked out well, but I think there was a lot of working from the gut just because we were on such a short schedule. There were so many complicated scenes, none that we really struggled with to the end. It felt like it fell into place, and it was a lot of hard work and a lot of revisiting the same scenes and thinking, oh, we can do this better. We can add some things here, or there's too much sound here. We need to remove some of the stuff and make it clearer. Any of the big set pieces went through a lot of iterations. The attack on the Harkonnen harvester towards the beginning of the film was a big set piece that I worked on for a long time. I cut a lot of that with the help of my team. And the worm ride was complicated, but it wasn't. It was fun. It was just fun to do. All those scenes are fun to do because the canvas is so big, so vast, and it's fun to make sounds for things like that. The goal is to really feel the power and the massiveness and the scale. And I love doing stuff like that.
What about your favorite single sound, just like a one-off sound for the film? What was your favorite one?
Let me think. The Harkonnens, like these battleships, battle cruisers, are bombarding the siege. And there's a great sound that Lee Gilmore actually created of these super rapid projectiles being fired at it. I love that sound. I mean, I love that scene. It sounds fantastic. The whole show, it has moments in it throughout that I just love and remember having such a great time working on. I love the night scenes on Arrakis, like when Paul's learning how to sand walk with Chani, and there are these lovely alien insects and occasional birds and one or two animals that may or may not be threatening or is a little scary, a little spooky. I really love that section. That's when he's learning how to sand walk, and Jamis, his spiritual mentor, he hears Jamis talk to him. It's a beautiful film. I'm in awe of Denis. He has such a deep feeling for this material and this world. He gave us a lot of rope to try things and really expand upon the world. And he was very open to anything that we wanted to try new or change. But he knew immediately if he heard something, he knew if it was right or not. He's a great leader in the sense that he gives you the freedom to feel like you're really able to create and invent and contribute new material, but he knows immediately if it's going to work or not, if it's the right sound or not, if it's the right vibe or not. There were some things that he was pleased with from the first film, like the ornithopters, the thumpers, the shield sounds. All of those, we rebuilt the ornithopters in Dune 2 from the components that were created for those things in Dune 1. But we had full latitude to add or to modify or adapt or make them new, make them feel fresh again. And they're all doing different things. So it's not as if we could actually use the, you know, lift the sounds directly from Dune 1. But those are the specific things that we used elements of from Dune 1. But he was very open to any new ideas, and it was a field day. It was really like working on that movie for a sound person was a great joy and a great pleasure. And you're on this fully realized world that Denis has visualized and created. And I'm so thankful that he invited me along in that journey.
That kind of brings me to my last question. Now that this journey is over and the film is finished, what's been your favorite part of the experience? What has stuck with you the most?
The whole thing. Starting out wondering how in the hell we were going to do this in the time that we had. Was it even possible? I fed off that excitement or that adrenaline of this is a tall mountain to climb. I just found the whole experience to be thrilling, frankly. And the chance to work with Denis and to work with Joe Walker was a thrill too. Denis is a masterful filmmaker, and Joe's a great colleague to have in the trenches with you and knows that world intimately too and has very good sound sense. The entire crew was a blast to work with. Working with Doug and Ron, having known them for so long, was like working with my two brothers.
Well, you have accomplished so much in the 2.5 months that you had for sound editorial. I mean, it's such an epic film and also a long film. And your sound team did an amazing job of just creating all of these sounds. And Ron and Doug, they did an incredible job of bringing it all together in the mix. Richard, thank you so much for having this chat with me about Dune Part 2. I really appreciate you sharing your time and your story with me.
My pleasure, Jennifer.
Bye, Richard.
Bye.
Looking for more audio-related podcasts to listen to? We're part of the Audio Podcast Alliance, featuring a hand-picked selection of the very best podcasts about sound. Be sure to hear the latest episodes from our friends in the community at audiopodcast.org. That's it for this episode. Thanks a lot for listening, and see you next time. Take care.